You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, from primary election results to a delayed Grants Pass homeless shelter and mounting health budget pressures in Shasta County. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And Roman, let's start with you. The Oregon primary election was this week, Tuesday to be exact. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of results from races, both statewide and local, and many people probably already know about some of those statewide races, Tina Kotek and Christine Drazen winning nominations for the governor's race, or overwhelming rejection of that gas tax. Yeah. But Roman, why don't you give us a rundown of the results of some of the local races we've been watching?
Let's first look at Oregon's second congressional district. So this is the district representing Southern and Eastern Oregon. It's the largest one. It's currently held by Cliff Bentz. He's the only Republican in Congress from Oregon, and he easily won renomination. He was facing two Republican challengers and easily, you know, defeated them. But there are some Democrats that are eyeing the seat, and they're kind of hoping to capitalize on a blue wave during the midterms. There were six candidates in the Democratic primary, and one of them came out on top, Chris Beck. He is a former state lawmaker. He served three terms in the Oregon House from 1997 to 2003, representing most of Lane County. And he talked about, you know, focusing on rural health care, affordability, addressing wealth inequalities. But, you know, he's going to have a difficult time in the general election because this is the only district where Republicans outregister Democrats. And, you know, it's.
And pretty significantly,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, pretty significantly.
Got it. So what about the state Senate? Jeff Golden, who represents Medford and Ashland, announced he wasn't going to run again earlier this year. And that leaves an open seat.
Yeah. So there were a lot of candidates, at least in the Democratic primary, running to, you know, compete for that seat from Jeff Golden. We honestly didn't really know who was necessarily the front runner for a while, but the results from the primary showed that there were two. Tanya Morrow, a lawyer who was endorsed by Jeff Golden, she got 34% of the vote, but she lost by just around 200 votes to Denise Krause, who might be a name people might be familiar with. She's previously run for the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. She's been on the RVTD board, and she led the failed effort to change the Board of County Commissioners to expand the number of seats, among some other reforms. You know, ballots can still be counted if they're postmarked by Election Day and arrive by next Tuesday, so that theoretically could change, but probably not. So Krause is going to be facing off against the sole Republican who filed to run, Brad Hicks, and he's the former head of the Medford and Jackson County Chambers of Commerce.
Okay, and besides candidates, there were some local measures in Jackson and Josephine counties. What were those, and what did the results look like?
Yeah, so voters approved a few different tax levies across the region. The first is the renewal of a levy for the Rogue Valley Transportation District. They've already been struggling recently because of a loss of federal funding, and they had to cut a majority of their bus routes around the valley. So, you know, they'll be glad voters renewed this levy, which will help keep those remaining services running. Voters in Ashland also approved a levy renewal for the Ashland School District. That levy provides around 10% of the school's operating budget and supports a lot of the school's athletics and fine arts programs. And then in Josephine County, we also saw voters approve a new levy to support the animal shelter. The shelter there has faced rising costs, and a previous levy from 2014, this is to expire next year. That one is interesting because voters actually rejected an animal shelter levy 2 years ago. But that one would have put money towards renovating the facility, and this new levy would fund day-to-day operations and basically keep the status quo.
Great. And last but certainly not least, the Josephine County Board of Commissioners. What happened there?
Yeah, so two seats were up for election there, and we've been watching closely because the previous commissioners were both recalled recently, so that's why there's two seats up for election. In one of the seats, the appointed commissioner, Colleen Martin, was running for a full term, and she got the most votes, around 46%. But because it's the nonpartisan primary and she didn't get above 50% of the vote, she'll have to face the second highest vote getter in November, and that is John West, who's a former county commissioner who was actually also recalled from office from this same seat last year. In the other seat,
in 2024, at the end of 2024?
And the end of 2025.
Okay.
Yes.
What?
Yeah, it's a little because someone was appointed, then he was also recalled. It's It's a bit complicated.
Yeah.
In the other seat, the appointed commissioner didn't run, but it also looks like it's going to go to a November runoff. The top two winners in the primary there were Chad Hansen, who previously served on the county budget committee, and Mark Jones, who's the chair of the Rural Planning Commission for the county and a retired firefighter.
And, there's a lot going on, and a lot we'll be following in the months to come.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Roman. Jane, you covered an update this week to a new homeless shelter coming to Grants Pass. First, give us some background on that situation.
So Grants Pass has had kind of a difficult time addressing its homelessness crisis in recent years. It's faced a couple of lawsuits over its treatment of homeless residents. One of those lawsuits famously went up to the Supreme Court, which ruled in the city's favor. And then in a more recent lawsuit settlement from last year, there was a ruling that the city must provide resting space for 150 homeless people. And so currently the city is doing that through a bunch of public city-owned campsites downtown, just on lots by the city hall and by the police station. But at the end of last year, the city gave $1.2 million to this developer from Roseburg called Elk Island Trading Group so that they can create a new homeless shelter facility with capacity for 150 homeless people. So that would allow the city to meet that court mandate and then also close the downtown sites because they would have room for 150 people at this new facility. And so the goal was for that new facility to open by June 1st.
Okay, we're approaching June 1st. What was the news this week?
Well, first of all, the city council authorized the city manager to have the power to adjust the capacity of those downtown resting sites as the new homeless shelter gets up and running. So that shelter will be called Parker's Place Village. So if it can accommodate 50 people as it gets started, then they would only need space for 100 people downtown, for example, which is really exciting for a lot of people in Grants Pass. A lot of people really dislike having those resting sites downtown, especially if they live right near them. There have been some concerns. So a lot of people are excited about the idea of finally shutting them down. Unfortunately, Parker's Place Village is not going to be opening on June 1st as was originally planned. There were a lot of delays getting site plan approval and international shipping disruptions and various other problems. And so they are hoping to have room for 40 people in the coming weeks shortly after June 1st. And then they're going to have sort of a phase transition from there to ramp up to 150 so that they're not basically overwhelmed with trying to sign up everybody all at once, 150 people at the site all at once.
Yeah, that's a big job. Remind us, how will Parker's Place Village work?
So the site itself is, the housing will be mostly converted shipping containers, and there are a lot of rules from the grant. So it has to be ADA compliant. It has to be low barrier. There are rules to stay there. You know, no illegal drug use, for example. It will be a managed site. There'll be security, laundry, bathrooms, trash disposal, hand washing, drinking water, parking. There's all of these things that have to be there per the grant. And then it will also have to have either on-site or easily accessible what we call wraparound services, so case management, substance use, recovery, mental health support, housing navigation, medical services, workforce development, all of these things. And so Elk Island, the developer, is going to partner with all these other local groups who will provide those services. And so the goal for the site is to have homeless people not stay longer than 6 months for them to get whatever issues they need help with addressed, get stabilized, and then be moved into a more permanent situation, more permanent housing.
Okay, so what happens next, Jane?
So there's currently 141 people on the wait list for Parker's Place Village out of possible 150 spaces, so there's clearly a need for it. People who are medically fragile or disabled will receive priority placement, so they'll be the first to go live on the site. The shipping containers are currently being refurbished off-site, and then they will be moved and hooked up on-site. So there's a lot of hard work going on there to get all of it done and have that first round of shipping containers on the site shortly after June 1st, and then they'll be ramping up from there. So again, the goal is to have 40 people in that first round in a few weeks and then have a phased approach from there. So it's a little bit to be determined, but we'll be following the rollout as it happens.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Justin, you reported on the budget situation in Shasta County's Health and Human Services. Well, tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, so the budget situation is not too good. As of this month, the agency has around a $4 million shortfall. And the director, Christy Coleman, she went to the Board of Commissioners this week asking for guidance of, you know, what should they do? She had some options that she presented. Those include both voluntary and mandatory staff furloughs of one day per month. So the voluntary option is where the agency would just ask for volunteers. And I guess they sent out a questionnaire to staff and got some positive feedback and numbers there. That would save over $1 million per month for the department. And then the mandatory furloughs would be the agency just choosing employees to take some time off. And that would save almost $4 million per month.
A furlough is where you would take the day off, but you don't get paid for it.
Unpaid. Yeah. That's a big issue. Budget issues aren't new for the health services agency there. Last year, they instituted a hiring freeze, and that saved some money. But the director said that she's expecting things to get a lot worse and that they need to prepare for that.
Well, why is the health agency facing these problems right now? And you just said it could get worse. Why could that happen?
Well, so like a lot of healthcare institutions in our area, it just comes down to low reimbursement rates and increasing costs. So the county just isn't making up what it costs to provide services. They're not getting paid enough, especially through these public programs. And that's expected to get worse because of Trump's one big beautiful bill, that reconciliation bill that passed last year. So there's a number of things in that legislation which will harm the budget situation for Shasta County. First is a lot of Californians could lose Medi-Cal coverage. So they would lose that public insurance, but counties would still be legally required to provide care in some cases. So they wouldn't be reimbursed for that care. There's also new eligibility verification requirements for state Medicaid. So many people on Medi-Cal will need to verify that they are working if they're able to, and counties will be picking up a lot of those administrative costs in checking people's eligibility. Shasta's health director basically said it's going to shift a lot of costs from the federal government to local governments.
And Shasta isn't the only county that's affected by this, right?
Right. This is going to have likely big effects across California. Shasta's health director, mentioned that a number of times. Other counties in California have already started finding ways to trim their budget, and that includes cutting staff. The California State Association of Counties released some information that really paints these changes as potentially catastrophic. And so this is a topic I think we'll be following for a while. There's lots of reporting for rural healthcare journalists in this. So the Shasta County Board of Commissioners approved a general fund loan of up to $10 million for the health agency that will help them in the short term. And then they told the health director to kind of check in with the public employee unions and then get back to them about the furlough option. But that seems pretty likely because they're going to need to cut some money soon.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. And Roman, you also reported on something in Shasta County, but this had to do with the city of Redding. It was about the Civic Auditorium there. What's going on?
Yeah, so the city council this week voted to look for a new organization to take over operations of the auditorium. Civic Auditorium is built in 1970 and it's owned by the city. They managed it for a long time, but then after the city had its own financial problems, they passed the management of the venue to a nonprofit called Advance Reading in 2011. And it's worked well for a while, but recently Advance Reading has struggled to not make enough money to stay open, and the city has had to provide over $1 million in emergency funding in the past year to keep the auditorium open. So now the city council is moving forward to see if another company would be willing to take it over and if they could do it profitably.
And why is the Civic Auditorium struggling?
Yeah, so Advance Reading was actually created by this local megachurch, Bethel. The church needed more space for its ministry school, so they created Advance Reading, and then Advance Reading would sublease the auditorium back to Bethel to use for its school, which helped supplement the budget, and, among other musical tours and normal events. And that lasted for a while, but then Bethel pulled out in 2024 after their school enrollment declined, and since then, Advance Reading has struggled financially. And because of the pandemic, there's been more volatility in the ticket sales market, and it's just made it harder for, not just Advance Reading, but also other event operators around the country to turn a reliable profit for these venues.
Well, and what happens next with the auditorium?
Yeah, so they're going to seek proposals for a new operator. It's a pretty quick timeline. They expect to select a new operator by July and have them start operations by October. But the existing emergency money for Advanced Reading runs out in June, and Advanced Reading says they're going to be winding down and turning over operations to the city. We don't know exactly how that'll work. They said they're going to offer a better timeline next week because there's a lot of events scheduled all the way out to November, so assume a lot of those might get canceled.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Roman. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.